Please join me in Matthew chapter number 12, verse number 15, where we wrap up the story that we were kind of finishing on last time, and that is the controversy in the synagogue about Jesus healing someone on the Sabbath day. In this very weird twist of thinking, the Pharisees believe that Jesus healing someone on the Sabbath day was work and therefore a violation of their traditional understanding of remembering the Sabbath day and keeping it holy. Now, of course, Jesus has already, in his response, shown that that's ridiculous, that the Sabbath day would be the perfect time to heal someone, to help someone out. That's certainly much better than harming someone on the Sabbath day. But the Pharisees are not happy that he continues to exercise this authority that the people love, that is in direct contradiction to what their authority position is. So we know that they begin to make plans as to how to get rid of him. Now keep in mind, this is 2 whole years before they actually crucify him at the hands of the Romans. So they've started this early, this confrontation, and it's only going to get worse. So once they've made their plots, apparently with Herodians, which as far as we can tell, Herodians were those within the Jewish community that upheld the right of a Herodian king to rule in Judea. Right now, it's a Roman prefect that has government position there. But the Herodians wanted the authority turned back over to somebody like Herod Antipas, who is the tetrarch of Galilee and Perea. But these guys together would agree that Jesus is a bit of a threat to the status quo, and he needs to be dealt with. So they are coming up with a plot to take him down. And so that's where the Matthew 12, verse 15 comes in. Jesus, aware of this, withdrew from there, and many followed him, and he healed them all and ordered them not to make him known. Now, that tells us that he was somewhere in Galilee that he then left, because that's where the confrontation happened. We don't know where. Galilee's a pretty good-sized area, but we do know where he ends up, because that is made clear in the follow-up in Mark chapter 3, verse 7. It says, Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the sea, and a great crowd followed him. So the sea that's in mind here is the Sea of Galilee, and probably the North Shore, based on some things that happen next, probably somewhere there between Capernaum and Bethsaida, Galilee, which is less than 2 miles to the west of Capernaum. And he's setting himself up in the same area that he's been doing ministry before. This is the same area where he recalled his 4 fishermen to become full-time disciples. And so they're right there on the shore. Now, these crowds come from all over the place. Listen to the catalog. It says, from Galilee and Judea, so Galilee is the immediate area, Judea is all the way down there to the south, all the area surrounding Jerusalem. Also from Jerusalem and Idumea. Idumea is where Herod the Great was raised. It's actually southern Judah. And so Galilee, Samaria, Galilee, Judea, and Idumea is all one big area of Jewish residency. And then also from beyond the Jordan, that's Perea area. Perea is on the east side of the Jordan Valley, another big Jewish area. And from Tyre and Sidon. Now, that's up in Phoenicia, and there are some Jewish communities up there as well. Altogether, this pretty much represents the totality of the Promised Land. So people are coming from all over the Promised Land. Verse number 8 continues, "When the great crowd heard all that he was doing, they came to him." And so they're coming in these massive crowds. "And he told his disciples to have a boat ready for him because of the crowd, lest they crush him." And we saw this already. That's the beginning of the story of the great catch of fish in Luke chapter 5, where Jesus borrowed the boat of Simon to use as a floating teaching area, as a floating pulpit or teaching desk. And so he's asking that they keep that boat on standby again in case he needs to kind of jump in it and push off because people are just getting too crowded up against him. Verse 10 says, "For he had healed many, so that those who had diseases pressed around him to touch him." So they're not waiting in line here. They're actually pushing to try to get up as close to him as possible. Verse 11, "Whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, 'You are the Son of God!' And he strictly ordered them not to make him known." We've talked about this before as well. He is not accepting the testimony of these fallen angels, these demonic spirits. He wants them to shut up and leave the people alone. Remember, demonic possession starts out as a free will arrangement where the spirit is getting things that they want and the person is usually getting something out of it that is beneficial to them. That's why they're willing to enter into the agreement. But over time, some people want out of the deal. And that's when the spirit becomes abusive. And the only way that they can be removed from the equation is an appeal to an authoritative third party. And so Jesus is that authoritative third party who's making these demonic spirits let these people have their free will lives back. And Matthew then chimes in to let us know that this is all a fulfillment of prophecy. Matthew chapter 12, where we were just a moment ago, verse number 17. You know, as we read through these Gospels, Matthew loves pulling Old Testament passages in as proof that Jesus is the fulfillment of messianic promises. So verse 17, "This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah." And then the quote is from Isaiah 42. "Behold, my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved with whom my soul is well pleased." This is God talking. "I will put my spirit upon him, and he will proclaim justice to the Gentiles." I want to break in. Matthew, as he writes his gospel, has apparently as a secondary purpose to encourage the evangelism of the Gentile world. Matthew is the first gospel written probably within a dozen years after the crucifixion and resurrection and the start of the church, but even less than that from the start of the evangelism of the Gentile world. And so he's pushing it. And so here is a quote from the Old Testament that he can proof text with, that God's plan all along was to evangelize the Gentiles, the non-Jews. But back to the text. "I will put my spirit upon him. He will proclaim justice to the Gentiles. He will not quarrel or cry aloud, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. So Jesus, while he is a strong presence, while he is an authoritative presence, is not a brawler. That's the point of this Isaiah passage. He's not out there fighting people in the street, like some sort of street fighter, forcing everybody to accept his way and being loud and insulting and argumentative, which I think there's an awful lot of Christians today that need to learn that that's not the appropriate way to evangelize. I think about those that foolishly yell and scream at individuals that are passing them by and accusing them of all sorts of sins, which no doubt they are guilty of those sins, but these foolish Christians want to be brawlers and act in a mean and vicious fashion toward these folks. And so that's not Jesus. That's not Jesus' way. This prophecy right here that Matthew's using shows that. Verse 20, a bruised reed he will not break. If you can imagine walking along the edge of a stream, and there's, you know, the cattails or the reeds that are there, and you see one that's kind of bent over a little bit. It's kind of bruised. And so just because you want to, you just reach out and snap it off. You break it. Or here's the other illustration. A smoldering wick he does not quench. They had oil lamps that they used. Their lamps had a wick that laid in a little notch at the front of the oil reservoir. And as the wick was getting used up, you would need to pull it out in order to let it continue burning. Well, it would smolder as it was losing some of its fabric, material that keeps the fire going. Well, in this illustration, you know, somebody would come along and they'd see the wick just kind of smoldering, and they'd just reach up there and snuff it out instead of actually pulling it out to let it catch fire again. What's the point? Jesus is not about breaking people beyond repair. He's not about snuffing people out. He's about helping people that are broken and bruised to heal. And we're talking about spiritual matters here. And to help them catch fire again, to have a right relationship with God. And so here's the rest of the quote from Isaiah. Until he brings justice to victory, and in his name the Gentiles will hope. There is this principle we see in Scripture that God does not take pleasure in the death of the wicked. He does not celebrate the idea of sending people to hell. He wants to fix their relationship and their problems. And so that's why Matthew quotes from this to let us know that when these people are gathering around Jesus, and many of them are there because they think they can get something out of him, physical, some physical healing, or they can get this spirit broken in their abuse of them, even though they are, some of them, trying to use Jesus, Jesus is still seeing this as an opening to try to help them develop a true relationship. Remember, his message is the same that all of the early church and old prophets was. It was repent, which means change the way you're thinking. Get your head screwed on straight according to God's standard, and then do things God's way. So that's Jesus. And so he looks at these crowds and sees an opportunity here to fix what's wrong, not just physically, but spiritually. Now, the Matthew account is kind of split up here, because over in chapter number 4, where we've already been, talking about the Galilean ministry, we see again the mention of the crowds. Matthew chapter 4, verse number 23. He says he went throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom. You know, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. But also he was healing every disease, every affliction among the people, so that his fame spread throughout all of Syria. Now, the promised land is actually part of Roman Syria. The Roman Empire stretches all around the Mediterranean Sea. And the eastern end of the Mediterranean, in the mindset of the Romans, was Syria. That whole end down there, what we call the Middle East, is Syria. And so all over Syria, people are talking about Jesus. And they brought to him all the sick, those afflicted with various diseases and pains, those oppressed by demons, epileptics, which the literal word is lunar, is moonstruck. And it's the idea that some of these symptoms were thought to be brought on by the action of the moon. But anyway, the paralytics, and he healed them. And great crowds followed him from Galilee. We know where Galilee's at. We've already talked about that. And the Decapolis. Now, Decapolis is a generally Gentile region. It's 10 cities. That's the Deca part. And Polis is city. It's a 10-city region that stretches around the south end of the Sea of Galilee, and then across the Jordan and along the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. 10 named cities there. One of them is on the east side of the west side of the Jordan. That's Scuthopolis. But the other 9 are on the other side. But there are Jewish communities in all of those cities and in all of those regions because it's part of the ancient promised land or land of Israel. So Jewish communities are there. So they're coming to Jesus on the north end of the Sea of Galilee, bringing their sick and their demon-possessed and all the other problems. And they're also from Jerusalem and Judea and from beyond the Jordan, which is a reference to Perea, which is all along the eastern side of the Jordan Valley. So same thing that we'd already seen over in Mark chapter number 3. And so they're all gathering right there on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee in a great big mass, thousands of them. And Jesus, chapter 5, seeing the crowds, went up on the mountain. Now, we have to break this up because Matthew does not tell all of the story here. For that, we have to go to the Gospel of Luke. Luke chapter 6, verse 12. It says, In these days, he went up on the mountain to pray. So Jesus has these crowds around him. He goes up above the Sea of Galilee, which been there, and I hope to go there again next year, and maybe some of you will go with us. That's in October of 2023. Check the website for that. But Capernaum sits on the north shore, and then rising up to the north behind it, there is this hill. Here it's referred to as a mountain. Don't think Rocky Mountains when you read that here. Think just a big, tall hill. And in Jesus' day, it probably would have had like orchards and vineyards and things like that along the edge of it. But maybe up on the top, it might have been a little bit more remote, maybe some trees and things up there. So he has apparently gone up here to be alone. He also has gone up here toward the end of the day. How do we know that? Because it says that all night he continued in prayer to God. So he has an all-night prayer session up on the hill north of Capernaum, probably very close to where the Chapel of the Beatitudes is located now. And what's he praying about? Well, one of the things he's probably praying about is the thing that he's about to do next, which is to designate his 12 apostles. Now, keep in mind, he has been ministering for an entire calendar year plus, and he's had at least 6 named disciples that have been with him for most of that time. And they are, some of them, full-time followers of him already. Now, a disciple means student. Apostle is different than that because it's somebody that you're going to pack things into so that they can take them somewhere else. It's interesting when you chase down the word, it's related to the idea of a barge. You know, barges get packed with goods and then shipped to somewhere else to be delivered. So these apostles are going to be packed with Jesus' instructions and then sent out into the world. And we'll see that in just a moment. We're going to have to bounce back and forth between Matthew chapter 3, verse 13, and then back here in Luke. So Mark chapter 3, verse 13 says he went up on the mountain, and we know he prayed all night, and then daytime comes. It says he called to him those whom he desired, and they came to him. So he brings his larger group of disciples to himself. We don't know how many that is. It could be over 100. But he's going to select now 12 from that group. Verse number 14 in Mark 3 says, "And he appointed 12 whom he also named apostles, so that they might be with him, and he might send them out to preach and have authority to cast out demons." So that's his purpose in designating these specific 12 men. They are going to have a job now to stick with him, soak up everything that he's teaching them, and then, they don't know it yet, but once he has died and resurrected and ascended, they're going to go out there and establish the Lord's church and get that first generation going with the gospel message. Then we get their names. The list is pretty much the same in both. It starts with the guys that we know so well. He appointed the 12. Shimon, whom he gave the name Petros, or Kephe, is the Aramaic name. So this is Simon Peter. Simon has been with Jesus for well over a year. And so he's going to end up being kind of that leader of leaders. James, the actual name is Jacob, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, to whom he gave the name Boanerges, that is, the sons of thunder. Now, these are his cousins. They are the sons of his mom's sister, Salome. They are the sons of Zebedee. We see that right here. Zebedee was a fisherman, probably also a priest, according to the early church traditions. But he was probably the top guy in this fishing business, which now James and John have walked away from in order to be followers of Jesus. And so did Simon and Andrew, who were business partners in this same fishing concern. Now, Mark, who is telling this from Peter's perspective, according to the traditions of the church, said that Jesus had already given these two brothers a special nickname, Boanerges, which is it's kind of an Aramaic Greek merge here. Sons of thunder. These guys were kind of fiery, and he may have known that growing up with them. Now, verse number 18 then starts off by mentioning Andrew, who is kind of the left out guy of the four. Peter, James, John become the trio that Jesus has as his innermost circle. But Andrew is Peter's brother and was there in the very beginning as one of the first six disciples of Jesus more than a year ago. Then we have the other guys that were first there over a year. Philip and Bartholomew. Bartholomew's other name is Nathaniel. And then we have other famous people. Matthew, whose original name was Levi. Jesus probably gave him the nickname Matthew because that means the gift of God or the giftedness of God, something along that line. And then we've got Thomas, or Didymus is his Aramaic name, I think. That means twin, so he may have been one of a set of twin. Then we've got James or Jacob, the son of Alphaeus. And then we have Thaddeus, which is probably a nickname. He's known in a couple of different manuscripts as Lebbeus. Thad is the Jewish name for the chest muscle, and Leb is the name for the heart. So Thaddeus and Lebbeus both have this idea of somebody that's beloved, somebody that's your bosom buddy, and so it's probably a nickname. And then Simon the Cananean, or Simon the Zealot. Cananean here is an Aramaic word that has the idea of somebody who is part of the Zealot political movement, that wants to see Jewish people running things in the Promised Land. And then Judas Iscariot, who's always listed as the one who betrayed him. And so now Jesus prayed all night, has selected his apostles, and now he's going to launch into that famous address that we call the Sermon on the Mount.